What's up, everybody? This is Rob Cruz. Welcome to Transcending Sport. I am back once again with my favorite guest, Dr. Rick Pauley, pitching coach extraordinaire. He's joining the Transcending Sport podcast to talk pitching, movement, development, hitting, pitching. We're going to talk about it all. Dr. Pauley, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you there, Mr. Cruz, my favorite hitting guy, and great to be back. These podcasts are a lot of fun, and I think we always have some informational and entertaining stuff to pass on to some people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I wanted to start off with just kind of talking to you about what's new with you and what you're doing. Are you doing anything new? I mean, people already know who you are, so but if you don't know who Rick Pauley is, and our relationship, I had the opportunity to coach. I didn't directly coach his daughter, but I was the hitting coach on the USSSA Pride, and she was one of our pitchers. Not only was she one of our pitchers, but I always like to brag about the fact that she is the all-time strikeout leader in the National Pro Fast Pitch Leader, in the National Pro Fast Pitch League. So, and then obviously I met Rick through her, And the rest is history. We became friends, and we like to bounce ideas back and forth on each other, especially on the level of technology. So that's that. So what you got going on new?
Yeah, well, I tell you what. I think I've upped my game a little bit in the last couple years. You know, I do a lot of private pitching lessons. I do pitching clinics. I do some Zoom internet training, things like that. I do some virtual lessons. But I've gotten into what I call corrective exercise programs for my pitchers. It used to be, I guess I'm going to use this term, that all of us big egoed pitching coaches think we have a pitching drill to correct any flaw a kid has. And I came to the realization that we don't. Some kids cannot be corrected with a pitching drill, and what's required then is some kind of a rebalance of their muscles. They got an imbalance of muscles that's just not letting them move the way that they should to be an efficient pitcher. So I've done a lot of studying. I've done some certification programs with National Academy of Sports Medicine, where I've done their corrective exercise specialist program. I've done their performance enhancement program. And then, of course, you and I, we always on these podcasts talk about our good friends over at 4D Motion. And I use the human performance app on 4D Motion so I can see, basically, it's going to tell us the range of motion of every joint in that pitcher's body. And, you know, we put them through a battery of physical assessments, and we measure things both with something like 4D, or we, you know, with NASM, you're trained visually to see what we call inefficiencies. So I do that, and I subscribe to a really cool app. It's called Muscle in Motion. And if anybody wants to learn about how a muscle works, where it's attached, how it moves, what joint it moves, etc., I would tell you, take a look at Muscle in Motion. It's some really good stuff.
I'll definitely be checking that out.
Yeah, it's very, very professionally done. And what I like about it, I say professionally done, and it's done at a level that somebody like me can really understand it. It's not something that only an orthopedic surgeon could understand, you know?
Let me ask you this. Go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that that's it. I apply that to my students, my lessons, and it's made a huge difference for some kids. Really big difference.
I want to ask you a question. Out of all the things that you're doing now in terms of understanding how the body works and how those things that the body is or isn't doing affect pitching results and pitching outcomes, right? And I'm sure pitching outcomes, obviously that's the whole point. But now I'm curious, what are the top three things that jump out at you the most when you get a player that comes in first time, they're not really aware of their body, they're not really aware of any kind of movement limitations they may have, mobility issues they may have? What are the big three? Is there a big three?
Probably. I think I could wrap them off here. Before I wrap them off, let me tell you how we do the assessment. We've got some. These are pretty basic physical assessments that any good physical therapist or trainer at a gym ought to be able to do. But the first one is just, you know, simply it's an overhead squat. Then we do single leg squats. We do some side planks. We've got some internal, external rotation things we do with the shoulder. We've got a QL test, a couple other tests that we do. But I'll tell you what, here's the number one that jumps off the page to me, and it does because it's not just a performance issue with a pitcher. It's a health and safety issue. Okay. See, a lot of young ladies come in and have what we call knee valgus, which means when they do a squat, if this is the knee, the knees move inward. Okay. Well, that scares me instantaneously. And I'm thinking right away, we need to correct that just for the, to protect this young lady, because I think we all know that ladies have what we call a larger Q angle than men, because typically their hips are wider. So their femurs come down at an angle. And then when the knees also go in, that angle gets greater. Those kids are predisposed to a high risk of ACL injury. And do not ever want that to happen to one of my kids. So we've got a corrective exercise program just to correct knee valgus. You know, and if we get a side effect where it helps them land and stabilize better with their pitching, well, then hurrah, you know. So we see that one all the time, Rob. Another one we see is, you know, I'm taking this as kind of the terminology from NASM, but it's called excessive anterior pelvic tilt. In other words, the pelvis tilts in. We see that a lot. And when that happens to a young lady, and I'll bet you see this in hitting, they have difficulty with their hip rotation. The hips don't want to rotate because when a pelvis tilts in, it's not in line with the spine. So, you know, that's something that you can correct with rebalancing of muscles for sure. Okay. I would say the other one is it's a combination hip, knee, ankle mobility issue. And, you know, that affects the drive mechanics of a young lady mostly. A lot of kids, their ankle, their knee, and their hips just do not want to have much range of motion. And when we see that, these kids typically are the ones, when you see them and they go in, they try to go into a forward lean to drive off the pitching rubber, and their body pops straight up right away. And their drive leg, the shin angle, pops up right away. So they're going to have an inefficient drive. And so, yeah, we see that. And again, there's lots of corrective exercise. When I say corrective exercise, it's a combination of foam rolling and stretching muscles that are overactive, and then it's activating muscles that are underactive. So you're it's a whole balancing act. And
I think what you're getting to right now is, I would say a large percentage of, including my athletes, that I don't always have time to deal with those issues in a session. But I try to coordinate and get them to the right trainers who I know are doing the assessments the right way.
Yes.
Because so many of my athletes come in and they say, well, yeah, I have a trainer. Yeah, but is this just some guy with a whistle telling you to give him five more on speed ladders and the things they do, what are the hurdles they jump over? Is this just that, or is it you really go to a trainer? Because if you do, the first thing they're gonna do is they're going to assess you to find out what your custom program needs to entail to address your issues first. Any movement, especially
big word there. You said custom. It's custom. It's not one size fits all.
It has to be custom because you're an individual and you're not the next person next to you. So I think that's one. And then the other thing I'm finding is that the people who are getting these custom programs from these trainers. You got to find a trainer who understands the needs of a rotational athlete for this sport.
Rotational athlete. You hit the nail on the head there.
It has to be rotational athlete. Because if you're training football players, that other than a quarterback, a football player is not a rotational athlete. So I'll tell you
one of the scariest things I hear is, you know, my girl will come in or it'll be a new kid. And I say, are you in a training program? Well, we just started our training for high school, meaning, you know, 3 weeks before high school season, I start training. And I said, okay, who do you go see? Well, we have a strength person at the high school. And I just almost cringe because my vision is it's some knuckle dragging 300-pound football lineman, and he's got him pumping iron and setting PRs on bench press and has no idea how a rotational athlete should be trained. It's scary.
So, and I think that's my biggest, you know, and my biggest fear for my, and the best athletes are the most educated athletes. And in order for me and us to help our athletes more, we have to become educated in what they need in every aspect of their development, not just pitching it, not just swinging it, but nutrition, body awareness, taking care of their bodies. If you're lifting weights, how much are you lifting? Why are you lifting that much? Who said it was okay? Did you do an assessment? Are you hurting yourself? You know, is what you're doing contributing to your overall performance? Like there's certain questions that you have to ask. It's not just, well, I see everybody posting pictures, you know, in the weight room, or I see everybody posting pictures for trainers. But I always ask the question, did you get an assessment? No,
That's the first question I ask, Rob, and I'll bet you 75% of the time the kid's eyes goes crossed, like, well, what's an assessment?
What's an assessment? It happens all the time. And I'm like, the fact that you don't know what an assessment is means that you're not with the right trainer.
That's right.
Because you would have had a thorough assessment, very thorough, that would have produced certain results in that assessment so that that trainer would know where to go with you. And I think that's my biggest fear for a lot of my kids also.
Well, I'll give you another fear, and I hate to pick on you know, maybe the strength and conditioning world or whatever, but as long as we're at it, here we go. I have so many kids that come into me, and you know, they'll throw the ball, and I'll look at them and say, "What's wrong?" "Oh, I'm really sore." I said, "Why?" "Well, I had my workout last night with my trainer." And then the next time they come in, "Oh, I'm really sore." I said, "Do you have that workout again with that trainer? What does he do? Does he train a different set of muscles every time you go to a workout so that every time you're done with his training program, you're sore?" I really, truly believe some trainers, that's how they get their euphoria, is how sore can I make this kid be the next day versus did I customize a program going to hit similar muscles all the time, or, you know, every other time at least, but not different muscles every time.
No pain, no gain. But Rick, pain, no gain, right?
Exactly. Oh, no pain, no gain. It's unreal.
So for me with hitters, going back to that pelvic tilt thing, I'm really big. And what I learned from doing 3D motion capture, this is what it has taught me. It has taught me that the hitters that are hitting the ball the hardest, that are swinging the bat the fastest, while still maintaining excellent control of their body, have the best pelvic control. And when I say pelvic control, I'm talking about pelvic direction, pelvic sequencing, pelvic speed. That's the engine. And so I spend a significant amount of time on, one, helping hitters to understand how to move properly in the proper direction with the pelvis, because that's the biggest for me, and being able to get that separation between hip and chest, and having those things timed properly, are things that I spend a considerable amount of time on. And I think I don't always do it. Sometimes I do it in a screen, but sometimes I make the screen the drill.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like if you can improve how you do the screen, you can improve how your body resets itself and programs the movement patterns. Because these movement patterns are really, really, can be simple, and it's easy to fix them. It's not like it takes months and months and months to retrain movement patterns.
Yeah. I'll give you an example. Myself and I've got a business partner, Sean Walker, who's an excellent pitching coach. Mm-hmm. And we've developed a virtual physical assessment / speed building program. And it has been unbelievably successful. It's an 8-week program. And virtually, we receive all of the videos of overhead squats, single leg squats. We get their pitching videos, et cetera. Everything that you could get virtually, okay? It's not as good as if they were here at my place and had the sensors on their body and all that stuff, mm-hmm. but it's the next best thing. And so we craft a program, and it's customized for every kid. It's based on whatever their movement compensations might be.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's both their physical movements from the physical assessment, and it's really easy when you do the physical assessment, you see their compensations, they'll show up in the pitching mm-hmm. videos also. And so, yeah, you craft a corrective program for what needs to be corrected. And secondly, then we have a base program that's part of this that is just, it's strengthening, and it, you're probably familiar with, you know, spiral lines and fascia and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But it follows the spiral line around the body. So we're hitting all the muscles that follow that spiral line. And it's amazing because the spiral line is for rotational movements. Mm-hmm. And the success is unbelievable. And I'll give you what our experience is. I told you it's an 8-week program. Okay. Well, about 2 weeks into it, a kid might see a little jump of a mile an hour or something like that, but that's only because we probably woke up some muscles that they've never used before. Mm-hmm. But when they get to about week 5 or 6, they start seeing gains in speed. By the time they get from week 5 or 6 up to week 8, they've kind of got most of the gain that they're going to get out of that program. Mm-hmm. And the typical kid is getting lots and lots of kids over 3 mile an hour gain in 8 weeks. We've had as much as 6 miles an hour.
Wow.
And the thing about it is, it's not like we're taking a kid that throws 42 miles an hour and all of a sudden she's throwing 48. We're taking kids that are throwing 58 and 60 and 61, and we're adding 3 or 4 miles an hour to them. But just rebalancing or correcting movement patterns and strengthening. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you a question. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. In terms of velo, because I knew this. I don't think most people know this. But when you get to a certain level of softball, throwing it hard, let me just say this. When you're younger, you can throw it harder and have more success. But as you get older, what I'm finding and what I've found that what I'm trying to communicate with people is, it's not about how hard you throw it anymore, because at a certain level, the harder you throw it, the harder they're going to hit it.
That's right.
And I think so many people are chasing the velo. And I understand why you chase the velo, especially if you have a changeup, right? If you have a pretty good changeup, it helps.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But at the same time, I think movement and measuring how much a ball can move and how late a ball can move is so much more important than the velo by itself.
Yeah, well, that's what I think one of the neat things about this program that I just mentioned is the base program. Mm-hmm. It's a strengthening program. So what we do is we get the body stronger. So there are less moving body parts when you're trying to let go of a ball, mm-hmm. okay? We take their variation. Let's say they got a location variation of some big box like this. By the time they're done with the program, they're down to this little bitty box here because their body is more stable. You know, in hitting, you've got that spine stability measurement that you look at. You know, how stable is the spine when you're going into, you know, contact?
That's one of my secrets.
Yeah. Oh, okay. We won't give it away. Sorry.
No, I'm looking. Go ahead. Talk about it.
Well, we do the same thing in pitching. We're looking at the stability of the spine as you're letting go.
That's right.
You know? And I want it to be really, really close to 100%.
So let me tell you this, right? Let me tell you. Oh, my gosh. You're preaching right now. So for me, this the stability of the spine, it tells you how stable the pelvic actually was. That's one. And then two, it's going to tell you how stable the head is. And how stable the head is going to tell you how stable the eyes are.
Yeah.
And because hitting is such a visual game, we have to, the spine is like the key, because it's going to be the reason why all those things come together.
Yep.
And if I can get my players to come up, I mean, if you're in the 90s, that's amazing. The goal for me is, like you said, the goal for me is 100%.
Yep.
But I'll take 85, between 85 and 90, you know, for a player who, as an average, or put it like this, I'll take 85 to 90 as like a, you can't go lower than that. Like that's the
Well, power. I'll bet you see that's this, Rob. Yeah. I'll bet you know, you got a kid hitting off a tee. She can probably get 95%, you know,
oh, yeah.
swinging behind her back. But if you're throwing live to her, it's another story. It's a little more of a challenge, and that's where live hitting, if I'm guessing if you're up in the 90, 95%, you're really doing well.
I think everything goes down with live hitting. Plus, you have less stability on the dirt, too. A lot of times I'm doing this stuff inside on carpet.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing as being on the dirt with spikes.
Yeah.
It's a little different story.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah, speaking of dirt.
Yes.
There's been some rumblings about a change in the pitching rules.
It's more than a rumbling. Yeah.
So I want you to give us your take on how that's going to show up. Like, how does that affect us? How does that affect our game? Who has an advantage? Who has a disadvantage? Is there one? I'm curious to know what your thoughts are.
Okay, so I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the potential for umpires not recognizing when somebody's actually doing a crow hop.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, the rule now allows what they call a leap, where the foot can, the dry foot can detach from the rubber, and it can be, you know, off the ground a little bit as it's getting ready to drag forward. It used to be that was called illegal. Well, it's not, that's like leap and drag is what we're doing now. Good high energy drive out. Yeah. And that drag foot is going to get up, you know, an inch or two off the ground, and it's going to land, you know, instead of dragging all the way, it's going to be a foot before it drags on the ground. I'm 100% for that, because that's just good energy. The difference is with a crow hop, where obviously a kid jumps up in the air, they go out and they come down and they land on their dry foot again. And the dry foot actually, when they crow hop, the dry foot is underneath their drive hip. And then they re-engage and they push again. Now, here's what I will tell you. I'm taking this based on, you know, 100 years of playing the men's game in the olden days, okay? Mm-hmm. Crow hoppers don't necessarily throw any faster. So if somebody thinks, oh, I'm going to throw faster because I crow hop, I don't see it. Back in the day, guys were throwing 80 to 85. Today, they're 80 to 85 with the crow hop. But the difference is that jump, land, push again puts them another about 4 feet or so closer to home plate when they let go of the ball.
Okay.
That is the same as increasing velocity, because that's effective velocity. The hitter has less reaction time.
So are we calling that, are we defining it as a replant? Would you call that, are they calling it replanting?
They replant and reinitiate another push with the drive leg.
So here's my thoughts, and maybe I could be off, but this is what I was thinking. Currently in softball now, umpires have so many different interpretations of what illegal is and what isn't illegal.
Yeah.
And some of these umpires are not really softball people. They're kind of like basketball refs, and they're making some money on you know, in the softball season and the basketball off season.
Yeah.
They don't really know the game to know how to identify it. How do you train umpires to get close enough for the interpretation? I think it's going to be a mess. I mean, I think at the NCAA level, I don't think it'll be as messy.
Oh, I think it'll be worse.
Oh, God.
Yeah, because there's more riding on it, and there's more coach influence on umpires than you can imagine at the upper levels. Mm-hmm. And some coach from some big program who's got a crow hopper, the first time an umpire calls that, man, they're going to blow up. And guess what? They're never going to let that umpire ump at their place again. So there's pressure coming at the umpires there. I think the NCAA does a tremendously poor job of defining the difference between leaping and crow hopping. They ought to have an absolute, no doubt about it, video that says, this is a leap, here it is, here's a crow hop. Here's, if you want to know if it's a crow hop, look at these three checkpoints. And there's only
so, but still, it's
only two.
It's still judgment, like a ball or strike. It's not definitive, and you can't go to a replay.
Well, here's what I can
replay.
Tell you.
You can't replay the crow hop.
I maybe have seen more pitches than most humans alive. I can see it almost with my eyes shut.
Of course, okay. Of course you can.
You know, and I just don't understand why an umpire who's standing right there studying that pitcher's drive can't see that. It's going to be the biggest fiasco you've ever seen this year, I think.
I'm predicting. I'm like, why are they making a mess? Yeah. Why are they making it? It's going to be messy. This is going to be messy.
Yeah, it is.
We'll probably have a record number of rejections, too.
Well, I would guess that would be true. Yes, I do.
At least we have some subplots and some things to get to entertain us, though.
But if we go all the way back where you sort of started with this, we need to get it right at the youth level. Because I'm telling you, once a kid is taught and learns how to crow hop, they almost can't go back and do it legally. That you can't change them back. I've seen it. Kids get into college who crow hopped and they got called. Rightfully so, they tried to correct it. They were only half the pitcher they used to be.
Wow.
So if you got to get it at the youth level, you got to get it right there. And nobody should be teaching anything that resembles crow hopping. Teach a good high energy drive off the pitching rubber. That's what you need.
Cool.
So you kind of got me fired up on that one. That one is a passion play. I've said it for 100 years. The NCAA Rules Committee, they've made some good rules and they've made some not so good rules. And I can just feel the crow hopping coming in. And you know what's the pressure? They don't call it an international play. And everybody thinks, well, God, we gotta let it get by then, otherwise we're never gonna compete in the Olympics. Well, guess what?
You don't even gotta say it.
We still don't compete in the Olympics.
You say okay?
I'm sorry.
We're not.
I shouldn't say that. I mean, you know, we're second place and that's just the way it is, you know. But it's probably not the difference between crow hopping and not crow hopping. There's some other things in there, but I just hope we don't. Because think of the safety. What if you allow a kid to crow hop and now she's 4 feet closer to the hitter and the hitter drives one right back at her? That's less reaction time that the pitcher has.
I never thought about that.
To catch a ball. Okay. Obviously, it's going to be tougher on the hitters. They have less reaction time. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you go back and study the NCAA rule change when they went from 40 feet to 43 feet pitching distance, the reason they did that was because from 40 feet, they felt like the pitchers had a big advantage. You know, obviously, less reaction time for the hitter. Well, guess what? They moved the mound back to 43 feet. You know what happened the first 3 years? Batting averages went up.
Of course.
Yeah, because the hitters had more reaction time. Mm-hmm. Okay. I take that back. Let me correct that. They didn't go up until about 3 years. The reason they didn't go up is that extra 3 feet allowed the ball to move more, so there was better ball movement. So the intended result didn't happen until about 3 years later. Mm-hmm. But you know what happened 3 years later? It's when they changed from the white to the optic yellow ball.
Hmm.
you think about your hitting and your vision, would you want to hit a white ball or a yellow ball?
Yellow with red seams. I think the
white ball. There you go. Also.
It's not only the fact that the ball is yellow, it's the fact that there's two different colors.
Yeah.
That help you kind of recognize spin and how fast the spinning and movements can, how movement's gonna happen.
Yeah.
So that's big. But let me say this. Why? Because I didn't think about the pitcher's not the ball getting on the pitcher that fast. I never thought about that.
Oh, safety is a big deal.
But here's what I was also thinking too, as you were talking, the pitchers having that leap could slow down and limit and bring down the amount of home runs. I think there's too many home runs in college softball. I think there's way too many home runs. I think it's way too easy. And it's cheaper than moving the fence back than allowing the pitchers to get an extra couple of inches closer to the plate. Because what costs more? Moving the fences.
Well, okay, well, let's think about it. Now, you and I are probably purists, okay? To us, a great fast pitch softball game is 1-0 or 2-1, okay? To the normal population out there that watches it on TV and stuff like that, they want to see like a 7-5 game, okay?
Well, that's going to sell tickets.
You got to balance it out and see, what do you want? Do you want people to be interested in your game, or do you want a few old people like you and I that – you know, get excited over a 1-0 pitcher's duel. I'm okay with a few home runs.
I do not want to see a pitcher's duel, but I do want to see. But and I think obviously you want to see some offense.
Mm-hmm.
You want to see some stolen bases. You want to see some base runners go first to third, score from first on a double. You want to see some great catch. You want to see all different aspects of the game. But I don't know what I'm curious. I guess my question would be is what is the reason for making the change? Because when baseball made changes, we added a shot clock to the pitcher because it's slowing the game down. There's a reason. We did this. There's a reason why. Here's why we did it. What is the reason? I don't think anyone said that. I don't think anyone's given us a reason. Why?
I can tell you why. International. Because if our kids are ever going to be good at the Olympic level, they got to be leaper or crow hoppers. And that's just not true. So, I mean, would you want to call up Yukiki Wano and Monica Abbott and say, hey, you guys should have been crow hoppers. You could have been better.
wait,
how's that sound?
Wano didn't crow hop?
No. Heck no, Wano had a really good, powerful leap, okay? And almost a leap and drag. She almost dragged instantly, but no, she was not even close to a crow hop.
Wow.
She's about as legal as there is now in the international competition.
Hmm.
Yeah. And look, Monica, at one point in time, I think Monica and Wano were the two fastest pitchers in the world. And crow hop.
So let me ask you this. And you gotta help me with the timeline here. And I talk about this when I talk to my players and when I go out and talk to teams. Because once upon a time, 60 miles an hour in high school was like you're an elite high school pitcher.
Because you were it.
There weren't that many people that can throw 60 or 61, right? Mm-hmm. And I think obviously that number's gone up. So now at the collegiate level, I'm feeling like 70 is the new 65.
Getting to be there.
Do you think? And the young lady at Stanford showed us something this past summer, this past spring in the World Series. Well, she showed me something. I got a chance to watch her pitch live. I was in Oklahoma City when she virtually shut down Oklahoma. She didn't win the game, but she could have, as a freshman. I mean, she made them look human. And I had never seen anybody make them look human. And I'm thinking, could 75 be something that could be
normal? That can happen.
Could be normal? Could be normalized now? Like 70 is almost normalized. 70, when I hear high school kids talk, when I hear some of my kids up talk, they're like, I'm throwing 68, I'm throwing 67, I got to get to 70. And that wasn't even a thought years ago. 75, yeah. Though, I mean, because she hit 70, from what I understand, according to the Yakker Tech people, she hit 73, 74 a couple of times in that game.
Yeah. Well, the same thing's happening in baseball, Rob. You know, if you don't throw 95 in baseball now, you're nothing. You're probably going to be in the minor leagues, you know. It's almost that way. I mean, the speeds in both of our sports have gone up, okay? It's got to do with maybe there's some better training, I hope. I think the strength and conditioning programs are maybe the biggest reason. They're getting better, okay? The college athletes nowadays – boy, I tell you, when I send a kid off to a what I think is a good college program with a good strength program, I'm expecting, you know, I think, man, I got this kid right where she needs to be. I'm expecting at least another 2 miles an hour out of her from the strength program that she's going to do at college. So, you know, I don't think I would say 70 is the new norm. I would say 67, 66 or 7 is the new norm. There's a lot of kids that are dusting off 70. There's a very, very few that dust 70 and can actually make a ball spin correctly to make it move. Very few. Matter of fact, I'm having a hard time thinking of any.
Probably count them on one hand. You probably count them on one hand.
Yeah, I think so, maybe on two fingers, but yeah.
So, interesting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, in every sport that's happening. I mean, you know, you take swimming. Every time you turn on a swim meet, somebody sets a new world record.
That's true.
They just get stronger and stronger and stronger. I mean, so how do you think Jesse Owens would do nowadays on a 100-yard dash?
Oh, no.
Yeah, the poor dude would be dragging a parachute,
and
I'm going to
tell you, baseball's gotten to the point where if you look at the older, like if you look at like Wade Boggs and Tim Raines and Pete Rose and Paul Molitor, they would not be draft picks because everything's based on 100 mile an hour exit velocity now.
Yeah.
They would never even get signed. Because now the minimum, if you don't hit a ball 100 miles an hour, you will not be signed. That's 100% across the board. Every major league team, every scouting bureau is going to tell you, you cannot hit a ball 100 miles an hour. You cannot play in the big leagues. We don't care if you strike out. We don't care if you strike out 200 times. You have to be able to hit hard 100 miles an hour plus. And I think that's something that's changed, obviously, in the culture of baseball. So now the training culture has changed because what's acceptable to get to the big leagues has changed. Now the entire culture of youth baseball aligns itself with what the people who are the decision makers for where they want to get to are saying, this is what you have to be able to do. So when I look at when I'm going back to softball, I'm looking at hitters and I'm saying, I'm looking at hitters and I'm saying, what is it going to take for you to be able to hit a pitcher who throws that hard? How do we evaluate it? How do we train it? What changes do we have to make in the training world? And for me, I have to be able to get players so much more mechanically sound, because if they start to push too soon in a swing, because they don't want to get beat on the heat.
Yeah.
The movement, the late movement, and the changeup is going to be the pitch. Because I'm noticing that a lot of pitchers have multiple changeups now. That they're throwing at different speeds. They're throwing two changeups. They're throwing three different changeups. And the hitters that are not sequencing properly, that are not really learning how to delay the chest and delay the hands in the swing, aren't going to be able to hang. That's something that I have to change. I have to change how I'm. I have to put more of an emphasis on that in my training now.
Yeah, and here's what I would tell you from my end on the opposite end of the ball. We're the ones that are chucking it there at you. Is I think that, you know, people ask me how important is speed. You know, like, and that's usually a dad whose kid throws 42.
Right.
I said speed is important. Okay, because it's reaction time based for the hitter, but I think even more important than speed is variation of speeds. That's what you're talking about.
Yes.
When I send a kid off to college, I'm trying my heart out, whereas I'm bringing her up here through the ranks, Before she goes off, I tell her, you're not just going to have three speeds, you're going to have four speeds. Okay? If you want to be a pitcher, you need to have four speeds, which technically, in my book, is it's actually four different pitches, four different movement pitches. Okay? And I think every kid that works hard and has any kind of decent, instruction, they can do four pitches, and they can do, maybe one of them is dominant, but you can have three others that are really good. Okay? Mm-hmm. You can use any point in time. So, I want a kid, let's say a high school kid, she's getting ready to go to college. I want your drop ball to be at least 64. Okay? I want your changeup to be like 52. So now I got a big gap in here. Okay, so my rise ball is probably going to be 59, and I'm going to have an off-speed something, curve, off-speed drop, off-speed rise. We're going to chuck in here at about 54. Okay.
Let me ask you a question. Can I stop you for a second?
Yeah.
What is the speed range that the rise ball has to be in to be effective?
There's a trade-off. Let's talk college, okay?
Okay.
In college, I think your rise ball that's 56 or 57 can be really effective, okay? It's got to spin a lot. The revolution's got to be really, really good, okay? I think around 60 miles an hour is going to be an effective both spin metrics and speed. You may get up 63, 64 maybe is an elite rise ball. And I'm talking one that's got that kind of speed, but it's got spin metrics. Okay. It's got some kind of a 70 plus efficiency on the spin. You throw it faster than 64, it's likely it's going to be what you see on TV. It's going to be gyro. And all it's going to be is, I call it a slanted up daddy rise ball. Okay. It's going to have some gyro, so it doesn't fall quite as much as a drop ball, but it's not going to have any illusion of lifting.
What would it take, though? What would it take to get somebody to throw a hard rise? Stronger forearms, stronger fingers, longer fingers?
Both of them. Yeah, the finger, the grip strength, okay, which goes all the way down into the forearm. When you sling a ball on the end of your arm, and that ball's in this hand, and on a rise ball or a curve, you're trying to stay cupped under the ball, right? The centripetal force of that arm traveling that fast straightens out the fingers. The faster this arm goes, the more centripetal force that ball is placing on the fingers, the harder it is to stay cupped. If you don't stay cupped, you're going to get gyro. So grip strength, and that's, they say, well, how come guys can throw a rise ball, 78, 80 miles an hour. Well, look at their forearms. They look like ham hocks, okay, because of their grip strength down in here. These tendons running in here, that muscle, this grip is unbelievable. Hmm. Yeah, it's grip strength first and foremost.
Because I watch, when I'm evaluating pitchers and giving my hitters, like, the game plan, I watch pitchers that are trying to throw a rise ball, and they're trying to throw hard and throw a rise ball. And I'm just telling my kids, listen, that's a high fastball. This is what we're going to do. We're gonna zone down, belly button down, because she's throwing it way too hard, and it is not a rise ball. It is not. It can't do it. So don't chase it.
Yeah, like I said, Rob, there is a trade off in there, and it's different for every kid. It's kind of like what we're talking about for, these physical assessments. Every kid's a little different in what speed rise ball works for them. And what grip rise ball works for them. But I'm going to say in college, it's somewhere between 57 and 63 is, and everybody's going to be different. The best probably rise ball pitcher I ever had, you all know her, Chelsea Wilkinson. I mean, hers, when she huffed and puffed and snorted, it was 57, maybe on a great day, 58. But that thing spun 45 revolutions per second.
So most of her energy is when it went by you.
It sucked the wind right out of your lungs going by you. It was spinning so fast. The spin efficiency, it's everything. That's a combination of your spin direction and then, you know, how's the spin axis relative to the direction of the flight of the ball? Big time important. And you'll see it every time on a rise ball. You say, kid, okay, well, let's throw it faster and see what happens. And, you know, you got your DK ball or you got your Rapsodo or whatever, and you'll see the metrics start to decline. But if the ball is faster, there's less time for gravity to pull it down. So it still has quite an illusion of almost having a jump. So underestimate the power of gravity.
Go back.
It's an illusion.
Go back.
let's not get into that argument.
No. You can't just say that and then keep going.
Sure can.
An illusion. So let me tell you a story. I was in Peoria, Arizona with like 11 Major League Baseball hitting coaches.
Yeah.
And we were at Outback Restaurant.
And they tried to tell you their four-seam fastball rises, didn't they?
No. And so we're talking hitting, and I was the only softball person there. They were all baseball. And the guy comes up, a guy from a team, one of the teams, a hitting coach, says to me, tell me about this rise ball thing.
Yeah.
Because obviously he heard the rumors.
guy can't hit it, right?
He heard the tall tale. A ball that actually goes up. And this is prior to pitch design becoming more popular in baseball and getting that high seam fastball that kind of has that basically is just staying flat longer, and we think it's rising. Yeah. And I think physically, and people will say, well, I seen it jump. Okay. Maybe you did. But we know physically, the physics of it and the perception of what's happening with a rise ball is that because it's not on its way down,
it looks
to the same extent that the other pitches are on their way down, it gives you the illusion that it's jumping.
It does. And, I have faced some of the best pitchers in the world of my day, and if somebody had told me back then that the rise ball didn't rise, I would have said, you are absolutely crazy. It jumps, you know, it jumps this much. Well, then when you study the physics of it and you when you take video of it from the side, you see the darn thing goes up. And you know what? In a women's game, a good rise ball, as it's going across the plate, it's actually going downward. It's lost any of its upward trajectory. It's going down. How do you think that one feels? Yeah, that's why you hitting guys have your girl stand in the back of the box. Because you don't want to be in the front of the box on a rise ball because it's still got some angle.
You still got child ball coaches telling kids to move up in the box and catch it before it breaks.
Yeah, so wrong.
No, it's crazy out here.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, that's amazing. So Chelsea Wilkinson has the best rise ball you ever seen?
Well, at that speed, yes. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you who's got the best rise ball I ever seen in the world. And He was an old teammate of mine, Pete Meredith. He's now the pitching coach at BYU. Pete could throw his rise ball up close to the 85-mile-an-hour mark, and that legit had backspin on it. Okay? It would start at your toes and end at your nose. I mean, those are the fabled stories of people who faced guys with good rise balls. When you tell them it didn't rise, they would say you were crazy. But, you know, you do all the physics on it. A great rise ball spin probably offsets like 36% of the gravitational pull. Hmm. Well, 36% is enough to mess up anybody's eyes and brain.
Perception is everything.
Yeah.
How we perceive it. That's interesting. And so for me, like on the velo end of it, when I prepare, it's a highly visual game. And I know, you know, I do a lot, I spend a lot of time and I've done a lot of research and I've done a lot of studying on vision, perception, and cognition.
Mm-hmm.
Those three things that are happening before we actually move and swing.
Well, that's in your brand new hitting program you're getting ready to launch out, right?
Yeah, so the hitting program has launched, and it's the See, Think, Move curriculum.
Yeah.
Because you got the vision, you got the perception, and then you have the cognition, which is how and when and how well a hitter is actually able to take what they thought they saw. That's why it's seeing and perception. What I think I'm seeing, how fast am I processing it? Because that's going to determine how I move. All of my movement and all of my the accuracy of my bat path and the timing of my bat path, they're all relevant to visual information. If I have visual misinformation, that's when my mechanics begin to break down. That's when my bat angles begin to break down. That's when my contact depth begins to change and take a hit. But if I can train that and if I can make all my training see, think, move within the training, I think we're on to something, especially as pitching gets better. Pitching is getting better. Once upon a time, I thought hitting was way ahead, and I think it may be still the case.
It ebbs and flows, yeah.
But I think pitching
is kind of one leaps the other one. Yeah.
I think pitching is now making a move now lately, where mm-hmm. I think in softball, and I think with the hitters we're going to have to make sure as hitting coaches and in the hitting world we're able to be even better.
Yeah, I think, you know, from I'll speak for the pitching side. I think a lot more young ladies are learning the importance of not just the velo, but the other two biggies, the location and the ball movement. Okay. And maybe the third one. Okay. The variation of speed. So I know when I talk to people and I'm talking pitching, and about 20 times in a 10-minute conversation, I'll say, and it's really important. Well, I think everything in pitching is important, but you take spin, spot, speed, and speed variation. Those are the four biggies.
Speed variation.
Do not underestimate it.
So that's a part of my three S's. The speed, spot,
there you
spin.
Go.
I have three S's, yep. That when a hitter says they're going to have a game plan, they have to figure out what they want to look for. And it's going to be one of the three or two of the three, speed, spot, and spin. But I like speed variation because we were down in Texas. We were playing against this girl. She was an Oklahoma State commit, and she had a legit three different really good changeups.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing I could tell my hitters because they just weren't good enough. You got to have, not only do you have to have good mechanics, but you have to be talented enough and gifted enough to even be able to hang. Because it's hard to guess right when she had three different ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, back in the days, you could just sit on a changeup. It's the same changeup.
That's right. Yeah.
So if I sit change, I'm good. But now it's like, okay, sit which change? Sit which one? And that's what that's. And I always tell pitchers, I'm like, the fact that you don't have a changeup, you got to be out of your mind.
Yeah, I would feel like I would have failed a kid if she does not have a changeup.
Like you
totally failed her. Yeah, I failed a kid if she doesn't have at least three speeds, at least three.
Mm-hmm.
I feel horrible if the kid doesn't have a good four speed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And it because hitting is that hard when pitchers are changing. If a pitcher just takes her fastball and goes fastball outside corner, 63, and then goes fastball outside corner, 59, that's hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's hard. That is difficult. We're talking just the fastball.
Mm-hmm.
Now add movement to that. Whew. It's tough. So let me ask you this. Yeah. I got this question in mind. I was thinking about it before, and I'm are you finding that multi-sport pitchers let me ask you a different way, because I know you know where I'm going. I'm throwing you an alley oop right now.
The answer is yes. I know what you're going to ask already.
What are some of the differences? Because for me, I'm like, you might as well go play basketball and volleyball instead of trying to pitch all year round and just go play a sport and then pick up a ball and get back in a circle, and you'll see so many different. You'll see a significant defense. You'll see a significant difference in what you're able to do just from an athletic standpoint.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Well, I do. When I was in college and I was out on the recruiting trails at, you know, all the tournaments and everything, you know, all these kids are sending you emails, come and watch me pitch or whatever. When I would walk up to the field to watch a girl pitch, the first thing I would look at is, does she move like an athlete? But if she moves like a robot, I mean, she's probably been a pitcher only since she was like 9 years old. Mm-hmm. Okay. And probably has not got much upside to her. Yeah. From what you're seeing right there today. When I see a kid that moves like an athlete and she's got pretty good talent, I'm saying, you know, egotistically, I'm saying, I think I can really make something out of this kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they got to move like an athlete. And that's your multiple sport kids. You know, your basketball players, your volleyball players, that kind of stuff. Now we got field hockey in there. We got soccer in there and stuff like that. But move like an athlete. Yeah.
And I separated, big difference. I separated volleyball and basketball for a reason, because of the jumping.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And the jumping and the kind of plyo-esque things that are required from you from basketball and volleyball with soccer. Yeah. Soccer and field hockey are very similar, but they don't give you necessarily the jump and as many jumps. And I believe that the jump, for at least for hitting, the jumps translate into fast twitch. They translate into faster, efficient, powerful hip movement. What do you think? What are your thoughts?
Well, I would define it, it's similar. I would use a couple different terms, okay? Mm-hmm. If your sport, to be good at your sport, if it requires you to be good at accelerating and decelerating, then I think it's a great sport for softball or for pitching. Because in pitching, it's the same thing in hitting. I know it is. Pitching is a series of, it's an acceleration, then a deceleration, an acceleration and a deceleration. It's all about and doing both of those fast, accelerate fast, decelerate fast. That's how you create and transfer energy. That's what it's all about. And that's why, you know, the knuckle dragon 400-pound lineman that's teaching you to pull a sled across the gym floor,
right,
he is not getting you into acceleration and deceleration, mm-mm, okay?
Exactly. Yeah. That's good stuff. This was great, man. We can go all day. I know you had a long day, so have I.
We probably could, yes.
And I'm really glad we had an opportunity to chat a little bit and catch up, because we haven't caught up in a while. But I have been sending some kids down, and some kids have been getting down to you, and that's been great. And just to get them the exposure of some things that they need to hear coming from another perspective. From somebody who's done it, from somebody who's cut on a TV and his kids are in the World Series. His kids are doing it.
Yeah. Rob, I see your, you do a lot of really great Instagram posting stuff. And I listen, believe it or not, I listen to what you say. And you're one of the few that actually I turn on and I'm saying, you know, I think Rob could be a pitching coach. Listen to what he's saying.
You know,
it's so much transcends the sporting world, you know.
When I first started doing this.
Yeah.
I was doing it from a biomechanics perspective, and I still am. But back when I did it, and we were doing biomechanics, back then, people laughed at the biomechanics people. They were like, biomechanics? What? See ball, hit ball, see it and hit it. Like, what are you talking about? So, but when I was learning the biomechanics of it, I was also learning the biomechanics of pitching, baseball and softball.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also learning the biomechanics of obviously just throwing and arm action. And I started learning about decel, how injuries happen, how injuries don't happen. And I teeter-tottered around with some pitching. And a lot of the girls that I never pitched. I taught myself how to pitch. I had never pitched. But I had to learn it because I was learning movement. And when you start to understand that movement is movement, because everybody is moving and transferring energy differently. Some people are moving it, doing it better than others.
Yes.
For whatever reasons, right? But once we can figure out why this person is not moving and transferring energy the way that person is, and we can close the gap and get that person to move it better, move the energy better, move the force better. But we got to be able to identify it first. And a lot of times those things fall under these categories that biomechanics kind of solves those issues for us, whether it's speed, sequencing, timing and direction, or whatever, you know, strength, flexibility. You know, it usually falls under those categories. And then once we can have that eye for it and that trained eye for it, we'll identify it faster. And now with technology, you don't even have to have an eye for it. 4D motion, 4D motion can tell you better than anybody can tell you with precise numbers. Like, this is how fast she's rotating. Here's the speed gain from the pelvis to the chest to the arms to the back. Here's the spine angle. Here's how much she's moving. Here's how effective she is moving. Here's how ineffective she's moving. And then now what you're talking about with your program, now you have, once you identify it, now you have correctives. You have a corrective program. So really, nobody has any excuses anymore. As long as you got one of these, anything can be researched.
Yeah.
Anything can be learned. Anything can be found out.
Yeah. And that's the coach that I think, that's the good coaches, the ones that are, they're never done trying to increase their knowledge base.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and your course, like I've let me tell you, the amount of people, I think I will say half the people that are in my certification for hitting have already done your course.
Sure.
At least half of them. I'm like, so there's a correlation of people who want
to learn. We're hanging with the right people.
Exactly. There are people who just want to know and want to learn, and there are people who kind of think they know everything. There's two categories. Yeah.
Yep.
You know, and I think before we leave, I'd like you to just share because I'm sure there'll be a lot of people that are pitching enthusiasts, and whether they're coaching a team, whether they're an instructor, or whether they just want to help their kid. Could you please talk a little bit about your certification course and how they can sign up and how they can find it?
Yeah, I will. Thanks for letting me put a plug in there. Polygirlfastpitch.com. You know, go to the website. It's an online university, and there's different levels of certification. Or there's one level, it's not even a cert level, it's a beginner level. Okay, it's three simple little videos, a grand total of probably 60 minutes of video training on, here's the absolute basics. If you're laying on a couch someday, Dad, and your daughter comes up and says, hey, Dad, I want to be a pitcher. So you go in the backyard with your daughter, armed with this beginner course, you can help her get started correctly. The first certification level is intermediate. That's all of the mechanics that are involved in throwing a basic fastball. And that's, you would think, well, that'd be pretty simple, right? Well, I think there's 98 videos in there that teach you how to throw a basic fastball, okay? Then there's another level up called elite, and that's all about, you know, the physics of ball movement, making a ball move and throwing curves and rises and all that stuff, okay? But I'm going to tell you, you would think, well, oh, God, I've got a coach at Alabama and Florida and UCLA are all taking these courses. No, they're not. It's mom or dad, first and foremost, who are trying to help their own daughter. Mm-hmm. And then by default, the daughter's on a team. They start helping the other girls on the team. And pretty soon, everybody sees how good these girls are. And now their phone's ringing off the hook and everybody wants them to teach their daughter. So it's kind of an organic, ground-up kind of a growth kind of thing, okay? Mm-hmm. And I hit a milestone just a week ago, certified my 200th coach. 200 different coaches.
That's pretty good. Congratulations.
Yeah, it was fun. It's rewarding. And I have met some great people. Mm-hmm. I mean, moms and dads. And you know, you think, well, who's doing all this coaching and teaching? I forgot the exact number, but 40-some% of the people that take my certification program, it's mom, not dad. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what, I'll put my moms up against a whole bunch of dads. They are good.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because you know what women do? Women pay attention to details differently than men do.
Yeah, they sure do.
And they identify details, small details, and they're really good at that.
Yeah.
Naturally. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. So all this organic growth going on, you know, if I've got 200 certified coaches, and I know there's other people that are certifying and doing good things, and that's why I think you're seeing this growth in the skill of pitchers, okay? So, you know, let's get your program out there, and so you hitters can keep up with our pitchers now.
That's why I put it out there. I'm like, okay, we got to do something around here.
That's right. Okay, great.
All right, so look, we'll catch up soon. I really appreciate you coming on. We got to do this again. Like, maybe, like, obviously, you know, I want to do it again when we get into the season, the college season. Yeah. Like, we did, I think we did that last year. And we did. Things that came up, and I thought it was great. And then I think we'll have to do another one, obviously, when we get to the World Series. And we'll
absolutely.
We'll look at all the pitching staffs from all the World Series teams, and then we can kind of like talk about that. That'd be interesting.
All right. Well, great. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
We'll talk soon.
Yep. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.